The Movement Brainery.
The level of mentorship that you received was directly proportional to the inputs that you gave into the system. You know, I just said yes to every project possible, and I got involved, and I was very active. And as a result of that, that mentorship came back to me tenfold.
You're listening to Masters in Motion, a limited edition podcast about physical therapy leaders and their stories so that we can apply those same lessons to our own lives and the challenges that lie ahead. If you're like me, you don't remember a time when evidence-based practice wasn't at the forefront of physical therapists' minds in the clinic. Around the early 2000s, we had a major shift towards clinical research and how evidence was being integrated into clinical decision-making. We had clinical prediction rules, treatment-based classification, and the profession started to come out with its own clinical practice guidelines. One of the figures behind this shift was John Childs. If you're like me, you associate John with his role as founder and CEO of Evidence in Motion, one of the largest continuing education companies in physical therapy today. But his career isn't so easy to define. John is also a partner in companies like Texas Physical Therapy Specialists, a private practice with 36 locations, and Confluent Health, a network of clinics with around 240 locations across the country. He was also one of the chief architects of hybrid physical therapy education, which met early resistance but has since taken off with multiple programs beginning across the country. Meantime, John's managed to publish over 150 papers with over $10 million in grant funding. One of the things that is so amazing about all of John's accomplishments is the speed of his career. He did all of that in just 24 years as a physical therapist. In 2014, John was named a Katherine Worthingham Fellow by the APTA, making him the youngest person to ever receive the association's highest honor. While John certainly benefited from timing, the work ethic he had early in his career was unlike anything I've ever heard. As you'll hear, this was something John feels like he's had even from his early days.
Originally from Birmingham, Alabama, grew up in the South, and kind of lived there at least all of my, you know, elementary school, high school years, and then left after that and went to college at the Air Force Academy.
What kind of a kid were you growing up?
I would say I was probably a combination between. I was maybe an athletic nerd. I was very sort of, you know, book smart, not very street smart. I couldn't fix a car or an engine, and I still to this day, like, you know, changing a light bulb is about as far as I go, and I'm not sure I'm even an expert at that. I was book smart. I really wanted to, you know, do well in school and perform, and, you know, sort of I'm an achiever, you know, by nature, if you will. And then I was fairly athletic. I wasn't a great athlete by any means, but really enjoyed playing, you know, basketball, baseball. So I was sort of an athletic nerd, I guess.
And even back then, you kind of identified as an achiever. Where do you think that came from?
It probably stemmed from, I attribute a lot of it to my mom. My mom was bear in mind, this is the South back in the, you know, 1970s and 1980s. So, you know, women were not particularly, known for being in prominent sorts of positions. And, you know, there were certain roles and expectations of women in the South. And she was, very much a very terrific mother, but also had a very successful career, in the educational, system. She, started out as a teacher, worked her way up through administration, became a principal. She was actually, ironically, my high school principal when I was a junior and senior. So fortunately, we had different last names. So a lot of the, a lot of the students didn't know it. And I certainly didn't volunteer it. But in any event, she went on to become superintendent of a really large public school district. So she was just very much a an achiever herself, and kind of stepped out of the traditional sort of role, if you will, that maybe perhaps society would have expected at the time. And that just was very much a model for me to emulate and follow, and certainly something I always admired.
Yeah, I mean, do you think you felt pressure because of your mom being in that position, or was it just kind of more inspirational?
I mean, it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, it was inspirational, but I mean, she certainly had very high expectations of her, of her children, and so there was. I think it was healthy pressure. It wasn't unhealthy pressure, but and perhaps some of it was kind of self-induced myself. But yeah, there was definitely a desire to, to please and to, kind of demonstrate that, I could sort of follow in that path.
Yeah. Do you remember how you first heard about physical therapy, John?
Yeah, it's a little bit of an interesting story and surprises people. I really, when I went to the academy, most people go to the academy because they want to fly airplanes. And my vision at the time was not correctable enough to get it back to 20/20. I forget all the details, but I wasn't pilot qualified, so I knew I wasn't going to pilot training. I really wanted to go to medical school. I'd always sort of wanted a career in healthcare, and was actually selected by the Air Force to go to medical school. I got a slot, but I'm not the greatest sort of test taker, and I never could get a good enough score on the MCAT. I wanted to go to a top tier, medical school, and I thought at the time that really mattered. Maybe it didn't matter a whole lot, but so I never got in to medical school, and so I ended up pivoting to PT school. The Department of Defense has what they call the Army Baylor program, which trains a number of military therapists each year, and there's a couple of slots, that at least there were at the time. For Air Force Academy grads to go through that program, and I kind of jumped over into one of those slots. And if I'm really candid and honest, I was a little bitter at the time. PT sounded like a sort of, to me, from what I knew of it at the time, was sort of a step down, and was a disappointment. I mean, I went through a lot of just personal, angst, and you have such a limited view of the world, when you're 21, 22, and, I thought my life was over. I mean, it's just ridiculous, the things you think, but nonetheless, it was, in my own world, it was traumatic at the time. And, but of course, PT was the best thing that ever happened to me, and ended up, having a career in the military. So it worked out perfectly.
Yeah. So when was the turning point where you realized this could be a profession that you would enjoy?
Oh, I pretty quickly, once I got into PT school, I mean, I tend to be one that doesn't cry over sort of my spilled milk, so to speak, very long. And, at some point it becomes definitive, and there's sort of a line in the sand, and there's no going back. And I'm going to turn on my best sort of, optimism and make the most of it. And so that's really what it, kind of turned into was, turned it into a lot of what was a disappointment, turned it into, a lot of positive, energy, and try to go be the best, PT student I could be. So, once I got through that initial disappointment, I pretty quickly got over myself and realized, wow, there's a lot of exciting opportunity in the profession.
Hey guys, real quick. If you like the show and you want to connect with like-minded physical therapists trying to improve their own clinical practices and their thinking, just like many of the greats that we interview, then you've got to join our community. Just punch over to Facebook and search for the group Mindful Clinicians. We'll be waiting for you. Thanks. Yeah, And what recollections do you have about that program at the time?
I mean, it was intense. The Air Force Academy was also, you know, very intense academically. So from that perspective, it was more similar than different. But, you know, now this is grad school. This is your career. Like, you can't just sort of learn it for the test and then sort of dump it on Monday. Like, you actually need to, you know, learn this stuff because you're going to be doing it. So, you know, I would say that, you know, it was a full-time program. It was a master's program at the time. I think it was probably 18 months in length. So it was fairly accelerated. I think a lot of master's programs at that time were 2 years in length. So it was very fast paced. It was very much unlike probably kind of tradition. There were no summers off. It was, you know, 5 days a week. You know, don't get married while you're in the program was what we were told. And of course, you know, people invariably do anyway, but like, you're not going to get a day. You weren't going to get a day off to go to your wedding. That's for sure. If you wanted to get married, you could get married on a Saturday, and you know, you could leave after class on Friday. That would end at like 5 or 6 p.m. So it was physical therapy education, a la the military style, if you will.
Yeah, and yeah. So 1996, you graduated, right? And you immediately end up going to Tucson and doing an MBA. How did that happen?
Yeah, so I graduated. My wife and I were stationed. She was active duty at the time as well. And so went to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And I'm sort of an educational junkie. I was already kind of in, you know, still in sort of academic mode and had the opportunity to go to the University of Arizona through their it was a full-time program. It wasn't an executive MBA. It was a full-time program, but started it at like 3 or 4 o'clock, I forget, in the evening, and would go through till like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. So it was a full-time program, and just sort of did it. And this was, you know, before having kids. And you know, I'd always had an interest in sort of business, just generally speaking. And so I just jumped straight from PT school into my MBA while, you know, seeing patients full time.
Yeah, so you were in the clinic at the same time. Talk to me about what clinic life was like early in your career.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. I had a very just a fantastic mentor, an individual by the name of Kevin Johnson. Hopefully, he'll have the chance to listen to this podcast because I really credit him a lot with giving me some of the early opportunities I had. He was an educational junkie who himself really consumed a lot of, at the time, weekend continuing education. There wasn't sort of longer term certifications and really any notion of residencies. Maybe there was one or two residencies in the country at that time. Mm-hmm. But just, he was a real avid, you know, learner. And I was an avid, you know, sort of learner. So he embraced, me, you know, traveling on the weekends to kind of chase whatever weekend CE course I could go to. And so he was very supportive. He was always eager to, you know, it was informal mentorship. You know, it wasn't a residency, but, you know, looking back, like, I went through a residency that wasn't a residency because of his, his willingness to support my career. There were for a period of time, there were only two of us in the clinic. And so, you know, I would cover his patients when he was, you know, gone to courses or whatever, and he would do the same for me. So it was just it was a great, you know, collaboration. I give him a lot of credit for letting me, you know, sort of pursue, a lot of my educational journey. I mean, for example, you know, I would have to be down at the U of A, University of Arizona, by 3 or 4 o'clock. So we worked out sort of a side deal where I would start seeing patients at like 6 in the morning. In the military, patients will come in at 6 in the morning. And so I just moved my schedule up, still saw a full load of patients, and he would support me and then going down to the U of A in the evenings.
Wow. Yeah. So obviously you weren't, didn't have kids at the time.
Oh yeah. No, that was pre-kids. So it worked out.
And I mean, pretty soon after that, you end up going to the University of Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, I was in clinical practice for 3 or 4 years in Arizona. I was actually debating getting out of the Air Force, and I always had sort of an entrepreneurial kind of spirit, and, you know, maybe wanted to start my own business. I had no idea you know, what I wanted to do. And in that process of deciding maybe, you know, to separate from the Air Force, I ended up being selected to go back and get my PhD at the University of Pittsburgh. And it was a surprise. I was not expecting to be selected. It was, it's a long story, but I ended up going much sooner than most people go, and it didn't have a whole lot to do with me personally. It just happened to be the way the selection committee works. So, I benefited from that. But
yeah.
So I sort of got this very surprising phone call that I'd been sponsored, you know, to go get my PhD, and I was just shocked. I didn't actually believe it at first. I had to confirm it. I literally thought it was a prank call. And in any event, I'm an educational junkie, and wow, to be sponsored to go through a PhD program where you're active duty and continuing to, you know, earn a salary. I mean, it's, I'm almost squeamish to even share that in light of all the student debt issues we face now. But I was very, very fortunate, to have, you know, tuition covered and, you know, a roof over my head and a salary. And so I couldn't say no to that opportunity. It was too good of a deal to pass up.
Yeah. And so you get to the University of Pittsburgh, and talk to me about what it was like there.
Yeah, it was a shock to my system, to say the least. I'd been in, you know, clinical practice. I was, you know, very, you know, again, eager. I had gone to a lot of, you know, continuing education, but, you know, I'd really never done any significant, you know, scholarly activity and certainly research. And at Pittsburgh at the time, you know, this was the very, you know, sort of maybe middle career for individuals like Tony DeLito. He had just gotten there a few years earlier as the program chair. Julie Fritz, who, you know, most everyone listening to this podcast will know well. She had just finished her PhD. She was a newly minted PhD at the time. She was there. Jay Ergang was there. Kelly Fitzgerald was just starting his research career. And so I just, again, timing worked out very well. I got there at a period of time where there were some really, really smart, highly motivated individuals that were just starting their research careers. And I had the opportunity to, you know, really, you know, kind of fall up underneath their mentorship and work with some of the, you know, at the time, maybe not well known, but now some of the most notable, you know, individuals in the profession who, it worked because it was really a team. I think, you know, I credit that culture and environment where, you know, it was really about sharing and collaborating, and there was, less interest in sort of the acclaim and, you know, who was, you know, sort of first author and those sorts of things. It was really about doing meaningful work and doing it in a way that would have a significant impact on the profession. I got involved in the, you know, the development of the classification-based system for back pain. That's where some of my dissertation work came from, with the manipulation, you know, prediction rule. But to make a long story short, Julie Fritz ended up being my PhD chair, and, you know, I didn't know it at the time, although I had some hint of it. She was one of the most, I've never met a human in my life who works as hard as she does. And it's not just about working hard, but about being productive. She's the one of the most productive, physical therapy researchers probably in our profession's, you know, history would be my guess. So I just, you know, I had an opportunity to learn from some of the very best.
Yeah, you kind of got lucky. And
yeah, very much so. And it's, you know, luck is a strong word, because I definitely believe in, I mean, don't get me wrong, luck plays a part, timing, you know, the fact I even got to go to my PhD program, you know, all of those things are variables that to some extent were outside my control. But one of the things I quickly learned when I was there were other PhD students there that maybe didn't apply themselves in the same way. And at least the way it worked at Pittsburgh at the time is, you know, the level of your in-depth of the mentorship that you received was directly proportional to the inputs that you gave into the system. And again, I was, you know, one of these individuals that, you know, volunteered to, you know, be a lab rat and collect data at all hours of, you know, I just said yes to every project possible, and I got involved and I was very active and, you know, hey, throw me some crumbs and let me see if I can, you know, do something with this. And And as a result of that, that mentorship came back to me, tenfold. And so it's really, I talk about this a lot with mentorship. It's a push-pull kind of a thing. Mentorship is not a one-way street. It's goes both directions. And my experience has been, the more value you can add into the, sort of lives, if you will, of those individuals you want to mentor you, the more it sort of comes back to you in the other direction.
Yeah. I mean, and your work definitely paid off. In 2003, you got your PhD from the University of Pittsburgh. And at this time, you're kind of developing into a really respected researcher just 7 years after graduating. So I think you become an editorial board member for JOSPT around this time. You're kind of a researcher at that point, right? Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, you've got to put it in context. This was, there were a couple things that were happening. Physical therapy research, clinical research was really burgeoning at the time. Prior in the, 80s and 90s, most of physical therapy research was more basic science. And clinical research was really coming into its own. In particular, the whole, notion of evidence-based practice became, a big buzzword in the late 1990s and early 2000s from the likes of Dave Sackett and others. And so the timing of where, really was instrumental. And I got to be a part of that, real early evolution of establishing part of the clinical research, sort of knowledge that, maybe we can take it for granted now because physical therapy researchers are so well-funded and respected at federal funding agencies. Yeah. At the time, there were hardly any physical therapists that even sat on study sections at like the National Institutes of Health, for example. And so, I was able to be a part of that early development of that.
Yeah, for sure. But just 2 years later, pretty much, you ended up doing something different and starting Texas Physical Therapy Specialists. Had you always wanted to start a business? What prompted you to make that shift?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things were happening at the same time. I was finishing up my PhD, and while I was in Pittsburgh, I really had, a lot of great research is being published, but ultimately, how is that research sort of getting integrated into clinical practice? And it's pretty easy in academics, if you're not careful, to get isolated in sort of an ivory tower and become disconnected from clinical practice. And I credit Pittsburgh a lot, because there was a lot of emphasis around sort of translating evidence into practice. It wasn't enough to just publish research. You actually needed to have clinicians actually read your research and maybe learn something from it, and maybe their clinical practice actually changes as a result of that knowledge. And so that's really where EIM was born out of, was sort of this desire to try to connect research closer to practice. And so in early, 2003, 2004, stood up a couple of, at the time, just pure, continuing education courses. Mm-hmm. That then grew into, certifications and residencies and longer term, sorts of programs in a hybrid model. But that's sort of where, EIM was born. And, I had the good fortune of, working very closely with individuals like Tim Flynn and Rob Wehner and Larry Benz, who himself was already very successful in the outpatient physical therapy business. And it became, sort of obvious that if we wanted EIM to be successful, we needed sort of a use case to sort of test out some of the ideas that we had to really actually see if what we were doing in terms of educational content would have any implications for real clinical practice and busy settings with all sorts of compliance and rules and, patients and labs, show up on time. Patients, a lot of times in a, busy clinical practice, don't show up on time. I mean, there's so many factors. It's not so easy just to take research and just plop it into clinical practice. There's a lot of other variables. And so that's really where TexPTS was kind of born out of. And it was a very sort of symbiotic, relationship between the two in those early days.
And you talked about EIM. I mean, now, God, this is, 15 years or so later, EIM is a really big continuing education company. Can you give some perspective into how big EIM is these days?
Yeah, well, you know, in those early years, it was weekend courses. And then those weekend courses started to kind of get packaged into longer term. We knew we wanted to do longer term programs. You know, the evidence around a weekend course really changing your behavior from a clinical practice perspective is not very strong. On the other hand, you know, the longer term sort of deep dive programs, it just has a greater chance to actually influence your practice. And so we started off building out sort of the foundational elements of weekend courses and then added the online hybrid elements to that and started out with, you know, I think the manual therapy certificate program was one of the first ones, the orthopedic residency, and then the manual therapy fellowship. And so those were sort of the first, you know, programs. We, you know, partnered with a number of employers and still do around the country who work with us, you know, as a way to help really recruit, retain therapists. If you're an employer, at least in any part of the industry, but certainly in the outpatient space, you want to hire people who are hungry and want to learn. And obviously everyone's interested in salary, but maybe like, you know, being able to go through a certificate or a residency, like that's really what they want is their kind of number one priority is to be able to, you know, grow themselves in their career and get on a path to board certification. And so our programs really would come alongside employers and helping them do that very and accomplish that very objective.
And then talk to me about now Confluent exists. How did that come into existence?
Yeah, well, you know, fast forward, you know, over time, EIM, you know, we partnered with a number of employers and we worked with a number of employers kind of in a vendor-customer, you know, relationship. I'll use Physical Therapy Central as an example, really a great practice that Bridget Finley and a number of her colleagues started in Oklahoma. They were one of our first network partners at EIM. We had the clinics at Tex PTS at the time, and you know, we really had a lot of respect for Physical Therapy Central. They really liked our culture, and so there was sort of this you know, process where, you know, we would start to, you know, acquire and partner up with other practices on the clinic side, in at least in some part as a result of us having worked so closely with these practices on the EIM side. And so I sort of think of it as, you know, we kind of dated before we got married. And, you know, that happened with, you know, Pro Rehab out of Indiana and Breakthrough Physical Therapy. And so next thing you know, you've got this, you know, sort of patchwork, if you will, of clinics all under sort of similar ownership structure, but not exactly the same. And you know, got to give Larry Benz a lot of credit, had, you know, a vision and as in part with, you know, all of us in the leadership team to really put it together under one, you know, umbrella. You know, it's Confluent is it's, you know, fast forward to today, Confluent's probably got, I don't know, as of today, it changes every day, 240-ish locations in, you know, call it 20-ish something states around the country. But it's not just outpatient practices. You know, there's a number of large employers that do outpatient physical therapy. I think we're unique in the fact that it's outpatient PT. It's the educational business with EIM, not just in the postgraduate, post-professional business, but now our university partner business as well. And then Fit for Work, which works with a lot of large self-insured employers all over the country and helping them mitigate against work comp. So it's a lot of early intervention, safety ergonomics, and those kinds of services that really help employers keep workers' comp insurance costs down. So it's a unique business in that it's sort of three moving parts, all of which are interrelated and synergistic with each other.
Yeah. And I mean, John, I have to comment on this. None of these are like Tex PTS, EIM, Confluent. None are small companies. They're big. I mean, is that something that's kind of a career trend? Why didn't you just open up a small little clinic and just be happy with that? Why do more?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think I can say this for really all of us. I don't know. We've never once, and even today, don't talk about you know, sort of pins on the map, and we want to have 500 locations or 1,000 locations, or it's really not about size. Yes, we've gotten larger, but the goal was really to partner with really talented local leaders. We have a very distributed model of leadership where all of our local companies maintain their local CEOs and brands. And so it was really just about wanting to be connected with like sort of the best people in the profession who really wanted to leave the profession in a better place than when they found it. And, you know, lo and behold, when you create a culture that's really built on, you know, clinical excellence and investing in your therapist and compassionate care with, you know, really high touch, high engagement levels of service, you know, that resonates with, you know, patients. It resonates with referral sources. And so you sort of naturally grow, but growth for growth's sake has really never been at least a primary stated objective per se.
Yeah. And I mean, looking at your career, John, too, you've dove headfirst into all these steps in your career. Did you ever experience a dark side to that?
You know, I mean, it takes a toll. I mean, you burn the candle at both ends. You're gonna work a lot. It's entrepreneurship and building businesses are not for the faint of heart. Invariably, you have setbacks and failures that will put gray hairs into your head and cause you to lose all sorts of sleep. It's very easy for those on the outside looking in to sort of only see maybe the positive sides of the success, because we naturally tend to, you know, I don't want to say hide the failures, but, you know, we sort of, you know, those aren't the first things people are posting on, you know, social media when a clinic fails. But you're certainly experiencing those internally and learning from, you know, those mistakes. And so it's been the positives by far outweigh the hardships, if you will, but it's definitely not for the faint of heart.
Yeah. And I mean, in one of those positives in 2014, you were just 18 years after starting your career, you were named a Katherine Worthingham Fellow by the APTA. So that's supposed to indicate efforts that were frequent and sustained for at least 15 years. So what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge honor. Some of my colleagues at the University of Pittsburgh were actually the ones who nominated me. I felt incredibly humbled and honored to be sort of a part of that, sort of fraternity, if you will. And but again, it's like anyone who accomplishes anything, you don't get there on your own. And so when you see people achieve success, you can instantly know that they were surrounded by a lot of really smart people. And I feel like that's been, you know, perhaps one of my, I don't know, say signature strengths, but, you know, a willingness to sort of share a lot of the credit and not always have to be at the center of all the sort of attention, if you will. And if you're willing to make yourself part of a team, you know, where the sum of the parts is sort of bigger than, you know, the parts are individually, you can accomplish a lot of really cool stuff and be part of having some, hopefully what will end up being, lasting impact in the profession.
Yeah. And after that, you continued, the South College DPT program got started with the blended learning model. Can you talk about why you did that and the reception it had initially?
Yeah, you know, we had been delivering hybrid postgraduate education for a number of years, the residencies, the fellowships, certifications, et cetera. And, it became apparent that like maybe this same model of delivery might work in entry-level pre-licensure programs. All the programs at the time were, you know, brick and mortar. But why do, you know, faculty necessarily have to live in the same geography? Why do students have to live near the campus, et cetera? We had students in our post-professional programs traveling all over the country to attend, you know, weekend intensives. And so that was one part of it, was the, you know, maybe there was an opportunity to do something innovative relative to the model. We were also committed to delivering accelerated programs. PT education was, they were 3 years in length at the time. We wanted to build a two-year model. And this is back in, 2012, 13. The resistance was incredibly high. There were a lot of very well-respected and super accomplished individuals in the profession who, didn't say it directly, but indirectly, over my dead body, and lobbied really against this ever becoming a reality. And so it was difficult, but lo and behold, the regulatory environment supported it. CAPTI, the programmatic accreditor for physical therapy education, had rules in place that allowed for innovation, and that was a good thing. And so lo and behold, it worked. South College was our first partner, very innovative, school. We give them a lot of credit for sort of testing out some of these new ideas. They're still a fantastic partner with us today. And lo and behold, it worked. And the program became accredited and the outcomes were positive, and students were getting placed in clinics and, becoming employed and having successful careers and, all the things you'd want to see. And so, that resistance over time has sort of faded. COVID has certainly highlighted the value of hybrid education, perhaps more than, anything. Yeah. And so it's still hard. It's still not I wouldn't call it mainstream yet, but it's becoming mainstreamed pretty quickly. And COVID has certainly accelerated the adoption of, innovation and the value of online and hybrid education.
Yeah. And John, so we just passed the time this is being recorded. We just passed the 100-year mark for the American Physical Therapy Association. If you look into the future of physical therapy, what do you see?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what I hope we see is a continued evolution where physical therapists are very much sort of at the front of the care process for all things neuromusculoskeletal conditions. The data is simply irrefutable that when you get a patient with musculoskeletal pain into a care process where non-pharmacologic care is being delivered in an empathetic, biopsychosocial, psychologically informed way, the downstream cost savings are enormous. And so, hopefully we see more and more patients showing up directly to see a physical therapist first. And so I think that'll continue to happen. I think we'll see much more multidisciplinary and team-based care with, cognitive behavioral therapists and other professionals to really optimize the outcome. Chronic pain, obviously the opioid crisis is not lost on us as a profession, and certainly as a healthcare system, and physical therapists have an incredible opportunity to be part of the solution for that. And so hopefully we'll continue to see PT as a profession highlighted in innovative types of care models. And I'd say probably last but not least, maybe this is the dawn of value-based payment. I almost hesitate to say it because I vividly remember in the 1990s when Photo was really in some of their early days, thinking that value-based payment was coming in the 1990s. And lo and behold, we're, fast forward 15 years and we still largely live in a fee-for-service system. So, but the technology is getting to the point where, electronic medical records are almost ubiquitous now, or certainly becoming more and more so. And so the ability now to measure care through outcomes and linking that to payment, I think the technology is starting to get where that is feasible. And maybe we actually see therapists who deliver better care being paid more than therapists that perhaps deliver substandard care. And so I think that bodes well for our future as well.
Yeah. And now if you had to talk to the individual clinician, maybe there's the next generation's John Childs listening. What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's stay in a learning mode and don't believe everything you think. But be very curious and open and learn as much as you can, whether that be reading or podcasts or attending certification programs and other continuing education. And then associate yourself with great people around you that can mentor you. And rather than expecting mentorship to come at you, really look for opportunities to add value to those individuals' lives, whether it be participating in research or collecting data or you name it, a performance improvement project that maybe your facility is working on, whatever it may be. Just say yes, take advantage of those opportunities, and lo and behold, you end up getting connected with other individuals where you have more opportunities, and then success sort of starts to snowball a little bit, and one thing leads invariably to another.
That was John Childs of Evidence in Motion and Confluent Health. EIM is continuing to offer courses in 2021 and has several new virtual options. Check them out. And again, if you like the show, please consider two things for me. One, leave a review wherever you're listening. It just takes 2 seconds. And then head over to Facebook and join us in our group, Mindful Clinicians. See you there. Thanks for listening. Stay strong.